Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me together again after 2 weeks apart. How are you, Lucy?
I'm all right. I'm very happy to be here. How are you?
Very happy to have you. I'm fine, thank you. Am I allowed to ask you what you did or read or watched specifically with your week off?
Yes, you're allowed. You're allowed to ask.
Will you answer?
I can tell you that I have been reading about mushrooms.
Oh.
And mycelium and all that. So I'm reading it very late, the book by Merlin Sheldrake.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody else read it last year and I'm reading it this year. And it's totally fascinating. It turns out that fungi are basically in charge. There's lots of eye-opening stories. There's a zombie fungus that makes ants do what it wants and then grows out of their heads, but that makes them all sound malevolent. they're not malevolent. Well, those ones are if you're an ant, but it's incredibly benevolent and have sort of created the conditions for life and continue to do so.
They're basically running things.
They really kind of are. And they seem to be pretty good at it. If we wouldn't just keep, we keep putting our big feet into things and messing it up. But if we just let the fungi run things, it'd go much better, I think. How about you?
Do you know, I've enjoyed two things a lot in the space of 7 days.
That's good.
Seems like a pretty good innings to me. Also a year late. So I read Deborah Levy's Real Estate. It's the third and final installment of a living autobiography, which is more or less what it sounds like, an autobiography sort of written in real time, tracing thoughts and impressions and events and feelings. So it came out last year, but I just got the paperback, and I just think she's the perfect company. Clever, funny, sharp-eyed.
Oh, that's high praise.
Bullshit-averse. Just really, really enjoyed it.
Sharp-eyed bullshit averse.
Sharp-eyed and bullshit averse.
Oh, averse. Sorry, I thought you were saying like a universe.
No.
Right, I'm sorry. Gotcha. Yeah, I'm with you now.
And the other thing is a film, which is also out last year, I think. So this is just a year's lag always.
Terribly up to date.
I know, just your finger on the pulse. But it's called The Humans. Have you heard about it? Directed by Stephen Karam. It was adapted from a play.
Is it People Round a Table?
Yes, it's exactly
that.
Yeah,
so I have heard about it, yeah.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's
got Beanie Feldstein in, who's pretty wonderful.
Exactly, yes, really wonderful. And, I looked it up before I watched it, and I think its public review rating was 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 5, and I just thought, well, that's probably the film for me. And I was right. So I guess it's a dark comedy. Centered on, as you say, it's a Catholic American family. They're rather tense Thanksgiving meal in this creepy apartment in New York's Chinatown. And it's just brilliantly scripted. Nothing really happens.
I was going to say, is it horror? Because I can't really watch it if it's horror.
No, it's not. It's quite Pinterest. There's an unsettling, very unsettling undercurrent. Nothing happens except, in the best things where nothing happens, everything changes somehow. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so yeah, I won't say any more, but I really, really recommend it.
Well, this is the place to come to if you want to hear about things a year
year late
they came out. This is where you did not hear it first.
That's our unique selling point. Right, well, moving swiftly on, coming up on this week's show, On Time. As a run of the modernist and satirical novelist Sylvia Townsend Warner's work is reissued in Penguin's modern classic series, Janet Montefiore joins us to consider her life and work, as well as that of the poet Valentine Ackland, Warner's partner, forever in her shadow. But first, Lucy, over to you.
We're going to take wing and consider birds, the beings who have, as our reviewer says, populated our minds and dreams and got endangerment from us in return. Jeremy Minot is the author of Birdscapes and Birds in the Ancient World and has forgotten more than most of us ever knew about birds. He's reviewing 3 big new books on the cultural history of birds, and we're delighted that he can join us today. We have 12,000 years of birdwatching to talk about, so we better get started. Jeremy, hello, and many thanks for joining us.
Well, hello, and thank you for letting me join the conversation.
Well, you open your piece with a question, which I'm actually just sort of going to put back to you. The question is, what accounts for the extraordinary importance birds have had throughout history in our lives, affections and imaginations? Can you give us some of the reasons as you see them?
Yes, well, one of the reasons certainly is just that they're physically ubiquitous throughout the world. They're quite pervasive. They span the globe from pole to pole. They're present in every realm of land, sea and air, and probably most people see or hear a bird every day of their lives. So physically, they're just with us the whole time. But also, and more importantly probably, they form many different roles in our lives. Over history, we've hunted them, we've eaten them, we've adorned ourselves with their feathers, we've used their body parts for medicine, we've trained them for various kinds of sports and entertainment. We've made friends of them in our gardens. We've got a whole range of different relationships with them. And I think one reason why we're so attracted to them is that they just have this gift of flight. I think that's terribly important. They have a kind of freedom that we aspire to. We're also attracted, of course, to their physical beauty and to their song. But I think flight is one of the most important things, along with the fact that when we watch birds, we think we know what they're up to. We can see parallels between their social worlds and our social worlds. We see them eating, quarrelling, mating, singing, conversing, attacking each other and so on. And we think we can enter into their society in some kind of way. So we do have a special sort of empathy with birds, I believe.
Can I ask you, Jeremy, about your own fascination with birds? I mean, when you speak to bird lovers, they tend to describe their relationship with birds as having come about in childhood, I think, perhaps precisely because of that envy of flight. I certainly remember wanting to be a bird. Is that the same for you, or did you turn to them later in life?
No, I was interested from a very early age. And in fact, I've still got a copy of my first bird book, which is a scruffy little thing now, of course, and it was the way I was lured to go to school. I was promised that I could show the teacher some pictures from my bird book, and that's how they seduced me and took me to school. And my poor mother had to read me accounts from this bird book every night until I think she usually fell to sleep before I did, because it was basically a list of species with characteristics of their behaviour and appearance and so on. But by the age of about six, I'd almost memorised it by heart. And of course, in those days, children were more free to wander than they perhaps are now. And I was quite a feral child. We were lucky enough to live in the countryside, and I just went out for walks. No one asked me where I was going or when I might come back, but usually I came back when mealtime called. And I was lucky enough just to be able to explore the world for myself. And part of exploring the world was to very much acquaint myself with birds. Mm. And very early on, I was lucky that my brother, an elder brother, had this interest too. And the best present he ever gave me was to teach me bird song at an early age. So again, by the age of about 10, I guess, I knew the songs and calls of nearly all the common British birds. And that's always been a very important link with birds for me. Not just admiring the songs, but being able to recognise them. And they then become a part of the places that you're exploring. So I think sound and song is quite an important dimension too.
And a way of kind of keeping track of time passing and seasons, although I imagine they're slightly more confused now than they were once.
Yes, the seasonal behaviour of birds is terribly important, I think. And of course, in earlier societies, it was very important indeed, because they used birds as calendars to some extent. The farming season was dictated by the arrival and departure of certain birds. And there are all kinds of lovely quotes from classical writers like Homer and Hesiod illustrating that. And even today, people are terribly aware, I think, of the seasonality of birds. I mean, cuckoos, unfortunately, are now quite rare in Britain, as you probably know. The numbers arriving here from Africa are very much diminished from what they were some years ago. But in about the middle of April, actually usually about April the 15th, people in the village where I live now, they stop me in the street and they say, Jeremy, have you heard the cuckoo yet? They don't say, have you heard what Boris Johnson has just said? Or have you heard that Russia has been invading Ukraine? They say, no, have you heard the cuckoo yet? It's still important to people.
Yeah.
And the swallow is another marker of that kind. We mark the beginning of summer by the arrival of the swallow. And I'm certainly very sensitive to these things, like most birders and bird watchers. And on certain days every month in March and April, I go out listening for or looking for certain birds as key markers of the progress of the seasons.
Mm. We asked you to read all these three books that all came out in the same year on the history or the cultural history of birds. So they're by Richard Pope, Boreas Sachs, and Tim Burkhead. And you say that there are sort of three approaches that you can take when writing this sort of book. Can you outline those three approaches for us briefly?
Yes. I mean, they're all remarkable books, these, and the authors of all of them have thought very deeply about birds, but it's interesting that they handle the subject in rather different ways. And I mean, just as a rather crude typology, I suggest that there are three ways you can cut the material up. Either you can do it species by species, so, you know, something about the swallow, something about the cuckoo, and so on, or you can do it by themes, taking birds as entertainment, birds, the hunting of birds, birds in science, what we've learned.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
About birds over history. You can choose various themes and cut it up that way. Birds in medicine, birds in food, birds in farming. Or you can do it in a straight chronological way, starting with the prehistoric period. And Tim Burkhead begins his book with the Neolithic, and tracing it through to the present day. So those are three ways of tackling it. But in fact, none of them is a very pure way, because they each find themselves hybridizing what they do to some extent.
Mm. It sounds as though, from what you say, Richard Pope's book, it has a kind of narrative arc. Is that right?
Yes, it does. He takes a strong moral, or you might say spiritual, line. His book traces what he sees as a terrible decline in our relationships with birds. He thinks that, he argues that in the prehistoric period, he goes back to the Paleolithic, even earlier than the others, we had a kind of affinity or closeness with birds, and indeed with the rest of nature, because we were part of nature. And he thinks that in that period, we had a reverence for birds in particular that amounted to a kind of religious awe of them. And he traces history following that as a series of setbacks and declines, as human beings separated themselves more from nature and learned how to exploit it and eventually to destroy it, which is what, of course, what we're doing now. So he takes a strong moral line, and he sees the stage we've reached now as a really dire point in human history, where a large part of the natural world has been destroyed through human agency.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you about this, because he's talking about something we've been talking about it on the podcast quite recently. We had a piece about in inverted commas nature writing, and lots of people now who write about the environment or animals or any of this don't like that term anymore for precisely the reason you've said, because it's as though nature is over there and, you know, we can kind of look at it or be interested or do whatever we want, and we're over here because we're not part of it precisely. And so there's a change in perhaps a change in our attitude towards it, but the other side of that is that this change is coming rather late. Do you kind of agree with that?
Yes, nature writing is difficult, as you say, as a concept. Lots of people who write about nature are rather hesitant to call themselves nature writers because it has a sense of nostalgia or rather soft romanticism about it. Indeed, the authors of the three books we're talking about now are not, in writing those books, being nature writers. They're writing about birds and about nature, but they wouldn't be nature writers in the sense that, say, Gilbert Wright was a nature writer.
And as you say, all three books, I think, talk about the threats to the survival of birds brought about by humans in the form of climate crisis.
Yes, they all end up by talking about that, and in somewhat different tones of voice and through rather different journeys to reach that point. But they're certainly all agreed on that point, and the facts are quite undeniable. I mean, in Britain alone, if I've got the figures in my mind right, we've lost about 40 million pairs of breeding birds over the last 50 years. And some of the most iconic birds, like skylarks, cuckoos, and most particularly the turtle dove, have had declines of over 90% in that period. In a worldwide basis, it's now estimated that something like one in eight bird species is threatened with extinction. So the scale of the devastation is extraordinary. And although in the popular press, this is often connected with climate change, it's not really a story about climate change as such, because most of these losses have been caused not by climate change, but by human intervention, by destruction of habitat, by intensive farming, by urbanization and certain kinds of development and pollution. So although climate change is going to deliver the coup de grace to everything, it's not climate change that has so far destroyed birds. It's other human factors.
Right. OK, that's, well, yes. I mean, we knew it already, but there's a sobering thought. Boria Sachs's book sounds a bit different in its approach in that it sounds quite literary. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. It's very literary, and he has the most extraordinary range of reference. He quotes in English, but from a number of sources in other languages, including some Eastern references too, whereas most of the other books are Western in their focus. And he deploys his literature very sensitively and very effectively too. He quotes a great deal from poetry, and he quotes a lot from poets that you might expect him to quote from: Keats, Yeats, Hardy, Shelley, of course, Wordsworth. But he also quotes from a lot of poets and literary sources that I'd scarcely heard of, including one or two Chinese sources. So that gives an extra dimension of interest to his book. And he does it very sensitively. And the reason I think why he quotes so much from literature is that his main theme is the loss of empathy with birds. For Sachs, who sounds like a very interesting figure, we have a special kind of empathy with birds, such that an encounter with birds seems like a rather special occasion, even if we can't quite give an account of it. It seems like a special encounter with spiritual dimensions to it. And that really is the theme of his book. He goes so far as to say that if we lost our connections with birds, we would lose civilization itself. And that's his big theme. And it's a very dramatic and striking one. But as you work through the book, you see how he progresses towards it.
Do they suggest ways, in a small way, of helping you know, from the very practical of putting out feeders regularly, or do they think of things that people can do, or are they just kind of laying it out?
More the latter, actually. It's not a practical manual of what we can do in small ways of that sort, but they do engage with the large political questions that we have to deal with, which will have an effect on both the abundance and the biodiversity of birds in the world. And they are all engaged with those themes. And indeed, they all mention, as I say, the huge threat of climate crisis, which will change our relationships with the natural world a great deal in the end. But no, they're not practical handbooks.
No, I was just wondering, I'm actually slightly hoping for them, you know, because as you say, they're sort of tending in one direction. Tim Birkhead's is a bit different though, isn't it? You say, as you say, it's more traditional, starts with the Neolithic frieze, which he calls the birthplace of bird study, and then kind of moves on in a great sweep, does it?
Yes, it's a wonderful narrative. And the distinctive thing about Birkhead's book is that he's a scientist, which the other two are not. A very powerful thread in his book is the way that science has, in stages, taught us more about birds, bird behaviour, and how we interact with birds and the effects that humans have on birds. So it's a history of ornithology as well as of our relations with birds. And he's got a great gift for popular exposition, and he's published a number of very successful books that exhibit this. And this is the one in which he does it on the largest possible scale, a huge history from the beginning to the end, as it were. It's a most impressive sweep and a most impressive story, but it's threaded through with the science of birds. And one very engaging thing is that in each chapter, he shows how the relationships people have had with birds and their understanding of birds throw up certain puzzles which science can now solve. So it's a sort of scientific detective story as well as everything else.
I mean, it is that wonderful thing of that he's still very much an enthusiast, isn't he? I was having a look again at his book Bird Sense, which is quite a few years old now, but is just trying to look at the world, to see the world, or to smell, or hear the world as a bird would, which is obviously impossible. But it's really fascinating. And as you say, it gives you the hard science behind it. And actually, the surprising thing is that a lot of the time there isn't that much science behind it, because nobody's asked the question.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, Bird Sense is a wonderful book. Another wonderful one is the book he wrote more recently on bird eggs. I can't quite remember the exact title. It's something like The Most Wonderful Thing, The Inside and Outside of an Egg. But that's another very good book. He wrote another book which is more historical in character, called The Wisdom of Birds, which was based on the discoveries of the 17th century figures, Francis Willoughby and John Ray, who were pioneers in what he thinks of as modern ornithology. But at every turn, he tells these stories with a scientific twist, which for anyone with the sort of curiosity that I have, is a wonderful way of introducing them.
Just to close that loop, it was the most perfect thing, just so that everyone can find it.
Ah, thank you.
The egg is the most perfect thing. And as you say, all three books, they obviously have very different illustrations throughout, because they have a whole world of actual birds and bird imagery to choose from. But in fact, all three, and we've chose a bit of this for our illustration of your wonderful piece as well, so they show one particular Egyptian tomb painting. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, it's quite a famous painting. It's in the British Museum, and it's an Egyptian wall painting of a man called Nebamun, who is displayed hunting in the marshes, accompanied by his wife, who is very fashionably dressed, but unsuitably for that particular expedition, I would think, and his cat, who is also hunting with him. And it's full of colour and life and vitality and abundance. And I'm sure what it actually is meant to convey is the abundance of life in this world, and the life that Nebahum hopes to enjoy in the next world. And each of them refer to it, but in rather different ways. And one of the nice things about Tim Burkhead's reference is that he actually identifies all the birds in the picture, which I've not seen anybody else do before.
It's amazing, because there's lots and lots of birds in the picture as well.
Yes, there are.
So he goes through each one and says what they are.
Yes, in particular, though, I was amused that he spotted a very unusual bird amongst them, which is an African bird called an African finfoot. And I suspect that neither of the other two authors would have spotted that bird.
And one of the other authors homes in on the cat instead, doesn't he?
That's right. Richard Pope has a lot to say about cats, because cats have a very destructive effect on the number of wild birds. I forget quite what the figures are, but I think they're thought to kill several million wild birds in Britain alone. And Pope has something of a tirade about cats on the loose, as well as he does about other forms of human-related activity, human pets and human sports that impact badly on birds. And he focuses on the cat in the picture, which is also hunting birds.
A bell, you would have thought. I mean, that's not Nebba Moon wouldn't have wanted a bell on his cat, but I suppose the rest of us could use a bell. That might be one small thing to do that might help. Jeremy Minot, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Still to come on the show, Sylvia Townsend Warner finally starts to get the attention she deserves, and there's room for her partner, the poet Valentine Ackland, too. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi. Now, Sylvia Townsend Warner. Many of you will know the name, and some of you will have read her first and probably still best known novel, Lolly Willows, 1926's witty satire of gender expectations and the escape offered to one woman by witchcraft. But knowledge of the rest of her work is probably a bit sketchy. She is, paradoxically, says our writer Janet Montefiore, comparing her to Virginia Woolf, Stevie Smith, and Elizabeth Bowen, the only major British woman writer of her period not admitted to the canon of accepted classics. News of Warner's genius somehow has yet to reach the general public, she says. A flurry of recent reissues may now change that, and Janet Montefiore is chair of the Sylvia Townsend Warner Society, so we could hardly ask for a better guide. She joins us now. Hello, Janet.
Hello.
You describe Sylvia Townsend Warner as being like Cavafy, at a slight angle to the universe. What do you mean by that?
Well, partly, I mean, the obvious thing, that she's always a bit unexpected. I also say that her writings are a continually disconcerting pleasure to read, because they tend to sort of upset your expectations. And I suppose it was also a coded way of saying she's gay, as Cavafy was.
Quite a good way of summarising rather a lot, really. So so when did you first come to Sylvia Townsend Warner? When did you discover her?
In the autumn of 1981, I was in Dylan's bookshop, as it then was, and they had copies of PN Review, which I used to read now and then. And there was something called Sylvia Townsend Warner, A Celebration, which had essays on her, and it had letters by her, the letters particularly, and the poems. And I picked it up and I read it and I thought, who is this amazing writer? Why don't I know about her? And I started reading what was then in print, which wasn't very much really. There was Lolly Willows and Mr. Fortune's Maggot was published by Virago in 1978. There were a few novels, not very many. There were the poems edited by Claire Harmon, who was responsible for the Sylvia Townsend Warner celebration. And otherwise, I'd read things as they came out and reprinted.
If you first encountered her in the letter form as well, I mean, she was a, we're not sadly going to have too much time to go into this because none of the books that you cover are her correspondence, but she was a brilliant letter writer, wasn't she?
She was a wonderful letter writer. I was looking again at the thank you letter that she writes to Elise Gregory, saying, usually a thank you letter begins with some graceless comparison, like, I have never been given such a scarlet muffler, or this is the largest hawk I've ever been sent for Christmas. The letters are wonderful.
For you to see her published now as part of the Penguin Classic series must feel rather overdue, but I suppose it's interesting to think about why the canon might have been so slow to accept her. One of those reasons is surely, I mean, because she was very successful in her time, really, but surely it's something to do with the sheer variety of her.
Well, that was part of it. I mean, she was tremendously successful with Lolly Willows. It was her one and only bestseller. Nothing else that she published after that was received with sort of quite the enthusiasm that Lolly Willows was. I think in the sort of in the mid-century, she was a kind of a steady seller, a sort of a stalwart of the backlists. And I mean, obviously it paid Chatto and Windus to go on publishing her. But I don't think they made a fortune by it. In fact, I'm sure they didn't. But it frustrates me. I mean, there are all these volumes of Virginia Woolf's letters. And they're, they're terrific letters. But sort of Sylvia Townsend Warner's letters are terrific too. And there's no major edition of her.
I know Lolly Willows was, as you say, was the bestseller and is the one everyone knows. And I'm ashamed to say it's the only one I've read. And I read it quite recently. But it still strikes me as... It certainly feels very fresh, and it's a very odd, powerful, strange book, isn't it? I was just rereading the end. The end is extraordinary.
Yes, it is. Back in the 1990s, a colleague who was teaching a course on the 1920s said, "Could I think of something feminist of the 1920s that wasn't a room of one's own?" And I thought, and I said, well, there's Lolly Willows. And the sort of colleague read it, and he was very surprised. And he said, it begins like Jane Austen and ends up like Angela Carter, which makes it sound a bit imitative, which it's not. But I know exactly what he meant.
Yes, absolutely. I was just reading just a bit right at the end. And she's talking about, I won't say who he is, but she's just talking about his undesiring and unjudging gaze. It's a woman wanting to get away, to be left alone, you know, not bothered by any of those things, which still seems to me to be very sadly pertinent.
Yes, I'm afraid that's true. Yeah. While we're on feminism, I want to say another thing about Warner, which also comes from one of her letters to her friend Paul Nodoff. Nodoff has a daughter and says that she wishes everything good for her daughter and hopes that she will be fearless. She said it's fear that makes women sort of sour and prying. And if she is fearless, then it's like a tree having a good root and everything good will grow out. And then she will be full of mercy and grace and generosity. Mm. I'm quoting from memory, but isn't that striking? It's all back in the 50s, as you know.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And Lolly Willows is fearless. That's why she can do what she does.
Mm. We get lines like in Lolly Willows, the bit where Laura realises that she and all women are being held down, held back by, and this is a quote, society, the law, the church, the Old Testament, the Bank of England, prostitution and other useful props of civilization. And in a way, it's almost like that line there became a sort of manifesto for her subsequent writing, didn't it? She sort of works through all of those institutions in her various satires and of convention, including in The True Heart, the prostitution part.
Yes, indeed. And that's exactly what I meant by her being at a slight angle to the universe, since, you know, her enemies are all the things that conservatism says, you know, that they are the props of society as it is. Although Lolly, I suppose, is a bit like, or Laura, is a bit like Stephen Dedalus. She sort of flies by those nets rather than directly opposing them.
As it did for so many other writers of the period, the Spanish Civil War galvanised her politics, didn't it? I mean, we see this in the novel Summer Will Show. Can you tell us a bit about that one, please?
Well, it wasn't quite the Spanish Civil War that galvanised her politics. I mean, Summer Will Show was written before the Spanish Civil War, after she had joined the Communist Party. What she said was that she would regularly read the Times, and it was reading the reports of what was happening in the Times. They then had a very good correspondent that sort of showed her what was developing in Europe and how dangerous it was. And she and Valentine joined the Communist Party because they were opposed to that.
You talk about the tension between the sort of landed gentry in the big house and everybody else almost.
Yes. The heroine, she isn't bourgeois. She's an aristocrat. She's very much a member of the ruling elite. And at the beginning of the novel, she is inclined to despise pretty well everybody she comes into contact with. The middle classes and also the working classes. And then she's shocked by the loss of her children in the various headlong actions, including rushing over to Paris to try to reclaim the husband who has deserted her. For his fascinating Jewish mistress. Sophia is somebody who begins apolitical and comes, you know, one could put this very crudely, perhaps this is putting it crudely, she comes through to politics through falling in love with a revolutionary. And I think Frances Bingham is inclined to feel that this is what happened with Sylvia Townsend Warner, sort of thinks of Valentine as a sort of Shelleyan revolutionary who converted Sylvia.
We're talking about Valentine Ackland here, who we'll come to in much greater detail briefly. Sticking with Summer Will Show, this novel is also remarkable, and you touched on it just there. The protagonist goes to Paris to try to get her husband back, to prise him away from his mistress. But in fact, things go quite differently. The novel is remarkable for this aspect, for the love story. You say it became a cult gay novel. So when was that? And, you know, by contrast, presumably, how was it received at the time of publication?
I think people only saw the politics. I seem to remember one of the reviewers being who said that Sophia and Miller Lenuel, quote unquote, become great friends.
That is a way of putting it.
Well, the reviewer may have been genuinely innocent. I mean, you have sort of, it's a bit coded in Summer Will Show. There's, you know, there's this it's very obvious that the two women turn towards each other. And there's some scenes, there is innuendo, which Terry Castle very skillfully points out just by quoting it. And Sylvia says, "I will stay if you wish it." Sophia hears herself saying rather grudgingly, and yet something in her consents to that flush of pleasure, that triumphant cry. Then there's a gap in the typescript. "But of course," said Minna, licking an oyster shell, "we must be practical."
It's not that coded, though, is it?
It's not really, is it?
Well, she's taken Minna out to dinner, you understand.
Oh, okay. She's not just hanging around licking an oyster shell in their boudoir.
No, there's a gap between Sophia's thoughts and the next bit of dialogue, which in the narrative code means, you know, this is the next scene.
And the character of Minna is really quite striking. I mean, it makes, for one thing, it makes a nice change to see Jewishness celebrated in a novel of this period. It's quite different to the anti-Semitism we've come to expect of many contemporaries. So tell us a bit about Minna.
She's an extraordinary character, actually, at once naive and knowing. In her first meeting with Sophia, she is telling this story and Sophia is listening. And Sophia, who is at this point, has a very sort of ironic habit of mind, says, "Oh, yes, you're a performer. Yes, you're holding us all spellbound. Sort of, aren't you typically Jewish? You will rub your hands in the shopkeeper's gesture." And Minna looks at her and sort of parodically rubs her hands as if she knows exactly what Sophia is thinking. Although the whole room is spellbound, Minna says to Sophia, "It was you I was speaking to. Did you not know?" And I suppose that's part of the charge of the novel, that for both of them, it's sort of love at first sight.
And Minna, you get a clear sense of Minna as this incredibly strong kind of driving force of the novel and of her times there, as you say, as a revolutionary.
She's not practical. When Sophia throws in her lot with Minna and her side and actually sort of finds herself gun running for the revolutionaries, and it's Sophia that they choose to help, not Minna, because she's the one who's good at practical things. Minna is very good at speaking. Sophia is much better at doing. It's the sheer fascination of somebody who comes from an utterly different background, utterly different suppositions, and yet the two of them kind of, you know, they feel this instant affinity.
Religion was a recurring thread in her work. The Corner That Held Them from 1948, which you describe as her masterpiece, is a case in point. So how did she feel when her partner, Valentine Ackland, converted, or I think reverted, in fact, to Catholicism?
She was appalled. And she didn't precisely regard it as reverting, because Valentine had joined the Catholic Church because she needed to marry to go through with her original marriage, and I think she sort of dropped it very soon after the marriage broke down. So Valentine said she'd reverted to what she had always been. Sylvia didn't see it that way, but she was appalled. I mean, you're right, religion runs through her books from the beginning. And always as a repressive thought. I mean, that list of things that that Laura realises have been oppressing her, that includes the church. It's there in Mr. Fortune's Maggot, when Mr. Fortune absurdly tries to convert the islanders to Christianity. And by the end of the book, he decides they're actually better off without it.
And there's that scene in The True Heart, isn't there, where the spinster defaces the Ten Commandments.
Well, he does. He spins a cobweb across the Ten Commandments. And yes, there's an Anglican vicar who appears in it as an object of satire. After the death of Don Juan, which we haven't talked about, the pious courtiers and their hangers-on, they're the worst people in the book. And particularly the villain of the book is the sexton, who is a kind of bully with the whole sort of might of the church behind him. Rather paradoxically, Warner also had a certain amused affection for the Anglican Church. She very often quotes from the Book of Common Prayer, but I think she actually minded more about Valentine becoming a Roman Catholic than she did about Valentine's sexual infidelities. In the end, Valentine left the Catholic Church because she couldn't be doing with Vatican II and the dropping of the Latin Mass and so on.
Let's focus on Ackland now then, because you also review a life of her by Frances Bingham, long awaited, you say. So does it deliver on people's hopes for it?
Absolutely, it does. I actually think it's benefited by the delay. It's given her that much longer to think things through and ponder them and to make considered judgments, which I think she does very well. And also, of course, sort of between when it was originally going to be published by the Buenos Press and now, the letters between Valentine and Sylvia and Elizabeth Wade White have been published, and so she had access to those as well. The long delay was incredibly frustrating for Frances Bingham, but in that she certainly used that time to make it a very good book.
And so what image of Ackland do emerges from this book? I mean, from what I can tell and from what you suggest in your review, she almost single-handedly makes the case for Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, doesn't she?
No, she embodies the case for Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. This is my interpretation, not Bingham's. I mean, Frances Bingham, I think, wants to make a case for Valentine as a major poet. My own feeling is that Valentine had a very genuine poetic gift, but that, just as Woolf said in A Room of One's Own, she was terribly disadvantaged by being a woman, because she didn't get a decent education and she didn't get a chance to hang out in her late teens, early 20s with other writers who were sort of learning their craft and sort of building up networks and so on. There she was, taking refuge from her family in poetry. You know, this is not the way to learn your craft as a poet. It really isn't. You know, she had talent, but I don't think she produced that many really good finished poems.
This is what we mean by mentioning Virginia Woolf. If she had had access to the education, for one thing, but also to the society of poets, you know, the Auden set, they would have, in a sense, you get the impression that she probably would have been edited more, and that maybe being edited, I'm thinking of in particular of some lines that you quote from a poem.
I think so. I mean, one of the things I've said, and I don't think that Frances Bingham will like this, what I've said about the collection they published, Whether a Dove or Seagull, that I've read it more than once, and I found it pretty heavy going. Sylvia thought everything Valentine did was wonderful, or if she did see things criticised, she didn't like to say so. No, she didn't get editing. The other thing about Valentine was she was so insecure. You know, that was the legacy of her sort of very privileged, but actually sort of also very deprived childhood. The insecurity was very much part of her. So she might well have found editing difficult to take anyway. She didn't do badly with what she had. She produced a lot of poems, sort of, you know, enough for a collected poems, and some of them were very good. But it's a shame that she didn't, after Whether a Dove or Seagull, she never collaborated with Sylvia again. And I think that's a great shame. It has struck me sometimes that Sylvia's relationship with Valentine was not unlike Winston Auden's relationship with Chester Kallman. That in both cases, you have an immensely gifted writer who is also not particularly good looking, sort of falling in love for life with another writer who is sort of extremely glamorous and is also talented, but not as talented, but is not on the same level. And in both of them, the kind of the glamorous beloved found it very difficult to be sort of the handsome one, but also the one who was everybody thought of as the lesser writer. But there is one difference, which is that Auden and Kallman were able to collaborate creatively in their librettos, and Sylvia and Valentine never did collaborate again after Whether a Dove or Seagull, because Valentine was so upset by feeling that it had failed.
And would you say then that, so Frances Bingham's book, is its greatest value is in not in, you know, showing us this marvelous talent who has been, you know, too long overlooked. It's more in giving us a life in context.
I do think that, yes. I mean, she shows it's a wonderful study of a very unusual personality. because Valentine was that. I mean, clearly she was magnetically attractive. I mean, I read with awe of sort of all the women she had affairs with, including right through the war. I mean, she'd sort of had a lowly typing job and she sort of had an affair with somebody in her typing pool, apparently. And sort of, I wouldn't have thought there were so many willing women in rural Dorset, but apparently there were. So she was magnetically attractive. She was, she had a very acute sensibility. But also she was the person that Sylvia loved, and she was able for Sylvia, which not that many people would have been, actually. So I think, you know, a lot of people could have found Sylvia a bit sort of overpowering, so brilliant and so talented. And, you know, they had their ups and downs. They had quite a few downs, but they were always together.
And they helped each other.
They helped each other. And then, you know, there aren't so many lesbian mid-century writers. Frances Bingham has, I think, done a great service to our cultural history by sort of giving Valentine her place in it.
Well, we're talking about these two women in tandem would certainly have pleased Warner, and it feels true to the lives and times that we've been talking about. So, Janet Montefiore, thanks very much for talking to us.
Oh, you're welcome.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Jeremy Minot and Janet Montefiore. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Sophia Franklin. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.